Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm very sorry for the delay, but I was flown here this morning from Chicago, where I was campaigning until 1 a.m. last night in a small private plane. We were caught in a rather fierce storm over the lake. We were tossed around a bit. Finally, landed to some distance from the terminal where I ran with my luggage through the rain. I can therefore only begin with the immortal words that were uttered by the deposed Prime Minister of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, when he arrived in Peking and was told as he got off the plane that his government back home had just been overthrown and there was a price on his head. I'm very glad to be here. I appreciated the chairman's kind statements about my record of accomplishments and the fact that it would take him to noon to list them all. That might have included a few minuses as well as pluses if he was going to go on that long. We had a candidate for the New York Giants football team this year who came from one of the Big Ten schools, I'm not sure which one, but in any event told the coach that he had quite a record of pluses and minuses. And the coach said, well, let's hear about them. And the fellow said, well, back in college, I played halfback. I could throw the ball 80 yards and hit a dime. I could run the 100 yards in the full uniform in 10 seconds. I was also the played on defense and broke the Big Ten record for pass interceptions and made more tackles than any other back on the team. Coach said, that's really remarkable. What are the minuses? Well, he said, I exaggerate a little. Your chairman may have exaggerated a little in his introduction, but I'm nevertheless happy to be here. I hope there's some reciprocity of feeling. This, according to the newspapers, is not all liberal democratic territory in this part of Michigan. I am not here to make a political address, so that isn't the sense of a partisan address. And I'm impressed that this school has been the subject of what gives every appearance of being a landmark study in the area of academic freedom. This has been troubling virtually every campus I have visited. Back in my own native campus, the University of Nebraska, at the time I was going to school, the professors were required to fill out a loyalty questionnaire. And I remember very well the professor who came to the question that said, would you advocate the overthrow of the United States government by force or violence? And had to give it some thought. He wasn't sure which was the right answer. Finally chose force, but I should also add that speech I gave last night in Chicago was at the University of Chicago. I thought it went reasonably well, but a young girl, freshman, came up to me afterwards and gushed, oh, Mr. Sorensen, enjoyed your speech so much, it was superfluous. And I said, well, thank you very, very much. I'm thinking of having it published posthumously. She said, oh, I can hardly wait. Politics 1968, which is the subject of my lecture this morning, is not a superfluous topic by any means. It is serious in every sense of the word. More serious than any other election that we are likely to hold for some time. more serious in terms of the stakes, the choices, the issues, the likely results. Today I want to talk about only one aspect of politics 1968, not the politics of joy, not the politics of confrontation, not the politics of Wallace and LeMay. I want to talk instead about the politics of silence. Silence on the part of the candidates on major issues, and silence on the part of some voters with respect to the candidates. The major issue that I have most in mind is the war in Vietnam, for I know of no other issue which has so greatly influenced, colored, and altered the atmosphere in which this election is taking place. Some may say, no, it's the withdrawal of President Johnson that has the greatest influence on this election. President Johnson, it is perfectly clear, would not have withdrawn from the race had it not been for the divisiveness in this country growing out of the war in Vietnam. Some may understandably feel that it is the assassination of Senator Kennedy that leaves us with the choice of presidential candidates we have this fall. But Senator Kennedy would not have entered the presidential race and exposed himself to our violent political atmosphere had it not been for his deep feelings about the wrongness of our course in Vietnam. Some observers may say that it is these demonstrations and expressions of dissent which confront every candidate this fall that most markedly make this campaign different from previous election campaigns. But however long the list of ills confronting this country may be, there is no question that the discontent stimulated by the war in Vietnam is the chief cause of that dissent and those demonstrations. Indeed, it is a war unique in American political history. I know of no other war in modern history in which America's leaders have had such difficulty in persuading a majority of the electorate that this war, or a victory in this war, was essential to our national security. I know of no other war in American history in which its daily agony and misery were brought more vividly home to the average voter in his living room through the medium of television. And I know of no other war in American history in which the enemy, if we are frank about it, is aiming his efforts at American public opinion as well as American military forces. We can be certain this morning that the commanders on both sides of the battlefield in Vietnam are waging war fully mindful of the campaign being waged back here in the United States. And it would seem unthinkable that the candidates back here in the United States could wage their campaign without giving top priority to disclosing their positions and plans with respect to Vietnam. And yet that has not been the case. With the exception of one major speech by Vice President Humphrey and some very vague generalities and platitudes issued by the other presidential candidates, The American voter has been left largely in the dark as to what the next president of the United States is going to do about the war in Vietnam and the talks in Paris, should he take office. Indeed, we are told that the issue should not even be raised, that it would be unwise to have a television debate devoted to this sensitive subject, that we should concentrate on other issues in the campaign. Some say that it is in the highest national interest to avoid this issue, that either silence or support is required of the American voter, that the very purpose of those traditional clichés about a bipartisan foreign policy and about politics stopping at the water's edge is to prevent sensitive issues of this kind from being involved in a political campaign. Democrats are further advised not to raise the issue in the name of party unity. Republicans are further advised not to raise the issue in the name of national unity. Only the president, we are told, has all of the information required to make a judgment. And no nation, it is said, can stop in the middle of a war and debate its merits and future unless we are to encourage or assist our enemies. I understand the tradition and the kind of logic that lies behind these sentiments, but I do not understand how they can possibly prevail in a democracy. The future course and conclusion of the war in Vietnam and the bare outlines of the talks in Paris have not yet been fixed. How can we tell a nation that bases its very existence on the consent of the governed that the most divisive and far-reaching issue of our time is outside the political arena? How can we tell these demonstrators and protesters that their rightful remedy is the ballot box instead of the streets, if the most crucial political campaign of them all is going to ignore that overriding question? How can we confine ourselves to other issues when nearly every one of those other issues, whether it's our relations with the Soviet Union, our relations with China, the resources we have available to clean up our cities, the size of the budget, the size of the deficit, the size of the tax increase, the size of our balance of payments problem, the discontent of the young and the frustration of neglected black citizens, all of these issues are directly related to this continuing miserable war that has drained $30 billion a year, every year, out of our national budget, and for the last few years has absorbed one quarter of this nation's economic growth in terms of real output. Above all, how can we tell anyone, including ourselves, that we have to wait until after November or after the inauguration in January to find out what this country's course will be in Vietnam and Paris in 1969 and thereafter? I do not favor an irresponsible or superficial debate that might only further confuse the issue. Whoever is inaugurated president next January is going to have a difficult enough time keeping this country together, preventing an irresponsible surge of isolationism or jingoism. We ought to avoid terms such as warmonger and baby burner and appeaser and coward. There is no party that deserves to be called the war party, and there is no candidate who can claim for himself the exclusive title of peace candidate. And we should not judge any proposals, if they are made, on the basis of whether they are pleasing to the North Vietnamese or displeasing to the South Vietnamese or even the other way around, inasmuch as they are not voting in this year's presidential election. And above all, let's have a discussion of the issue that gets away from these slogans and cliches and generalities that tell us nothing. I was at one time a political speechwriter. I know how easy it would be to write an all-purpose speech on Vietnam for any candidate to use before any audience in this campaign. He would come out strongly, resolutely, and bravely in favor of providing all moral support for our boys in Vietnam, in favor of winning the hearts and minds of the South Vietnamese people, in favor of cleaning up corruption in Saigon, pacifying the countryside, turning more of the burden over to the South Vietnamese troops, maintaining negotiations so long as they were productive negotiations, and achieving peace with honor as quickly as possible, withdrawing our troops as soon as the violence subsides. And in the same speech, the same candidate should come out very strongly and just as courageously against abandoning our commitment, against letting the war drag on, against the policy of peace at any price, against any concessions to the other side unless they result in a prompt and satisfactory settlement, against any conclusion that rewards aggression, and against any risk of World War III. Now, almost no one would disagree with that speech, and absolutely no one would know where the candidate really stood, where he stood on the really hard questions, on whether, as the President of the United States, if the negotiations did not proceed satisfactorily, he would increase or cut back the level of our military activity in Vietnam, including the bombing of the North and our troop commitments to the South. Whether, as President, he would be willing to give the South Vietnamese government a veto over our diplomatic and military policies, or whether he would, and to what extent he would, attempt to shape political and economic and military reforms and actions within the South Vietnamese government. Whether, as president, he would accept or invite the risks of a wider war in Southeast Asia, or the risks of communists in South Vietnam's post-war government. Those are the questions which are not easy, but which have to be answered. Those are the questions which the candidates for the presidency in a democracy ought to be required to answer if they are to be true to their obligations to the people of this country. And silence on their part does not speak well for the choice which we have, or for their own commitment to the democratic faith. And because of their silence, and because many of us have good reason to be otherwise discouraged about this year's election, because Senator Kennedy was killed, and Senator McCarthy was defeated, and Senator McGovern was defeated, and in the Republican convention, Governor Rockefeller was defeated, because the minority plank on Vietnam, which I had the privilege to help draft and for which I spoke, because it was defeated at the Democratic convention, because a meaningless, inconsistent plank was adopted at the Republican convention. For all these reasons, there are many who understandably feel like keeping silent themselves in this presidential election, who feel that the enthusiasm and the hope and the vitality which characterized the early months of this political year have all been drained away now. So it is not surprising that many of them have announced they will not vote for any presidential candidate this fall. It is not surprising that your newspaper on this campus feels it cannot endorse any candidate in this fall. But I was happy to note that the newspaper went beyond a position of non-endorsement and recognized that a choice of some kind must be made. These are issues on which everyone must examine his own conscience. I do not speak for any other figure, but having examined my own, I feel that not for the sake of my party, but for the sake of my country, I have an obligation to vote on November 5. The realities of the situation to me are basic and unchangeable. Examine them for just a moment. First, no matter how much we may wish it were otherwise, the fact is that an election is going to be held on November 5, and either Nixon or Humphrey or Wallace is going to emerge as the next president, the next commander-in-chief with his finger on the nuclear trigger for the next 4 years, with all the power in foreign affairs and leadership in domestic affairs that goes with that office. We have an antiquated electoral system. It is possible that the Wallace people will be able to confuse it. But eventually, one way or another, either Mr. Nixon or Mr. Humphrey is going to emerge as president. Well, secondly, regardless of their similarities that some attempt to paint into them on key questions, and despite all the efforts to balance off their virtues and faults, Mr. Nixon and Mr. Humphrey are not the same. They are not identical. They are not equal. No two men ever are. One is always at least a little bit worse or a little bit better than the other. And no matter how slight their differences may seem to some, every voter who takes the time to read and listen with care will be able to discern which candidates' viewpoints and values are the least distant from his own. So third, no matter how the voter may feel the choice is unappealing and the difference is small, no matter if he grades one candidate C and the other one C plus, no matter how he wishes that he could maintain his integrity by ignoring the situation entirely, he has an obligation to his country, to his children or his future children, to his fellow citizens, to at least vote against that candidate which he has decided is least worthy of support. Because in a very real sense, everyone is voting. Even those who do not vote are by their inaction helping or hurting someone. The candidate whom they think is least worthy of support, who after this comparison they determine has the views furthest away from their own on all the issues, is counting not only on support from his own supporters, but on those who think he is least worthy staying home on election day. Mathematically, it has the same effect, if you stay home, of casting one half vote for that candidate you think is least worthy of support. Now, I know there are many who say they want to withhold their votes to show protest. They will be helping the very candidate they protest the most. But more than that, no one is going to be able to distinguish their non-vote from the non-votes of those who were too uninformed to make a choice, or from those who were too lazy or too busy or too sick to vote on election day, or prevented from voting by failure to register or change of residence or law or weather. To say that you will go and vote for the other candidates does not really help the situation any. There's always a widely fluctuating variation between the vote totals received by candidates at the presidential level and vote totals received by candidates at another level. And this year, with so many minor party candidates on the ballot in some states and not on the ballot in other states, no one is going to be able to measure or attribute any significance to any particular size of any particular protest vote, because that vote simply will not be identifiable. I should point out that the supporters of George Wallace are anxious to vote. They are angry voters. They will be there. And the smaller the turnout for the two major party candidates, whether Humphrey or Nixon, the larger will be the total proportion of vote received by Mr. Wallace, and the larger will be his influence on the next Congress and administration. I fully understand the motivations of those who, in the heat of the battle for the nomination, vowed they would never support in the election campaign their candidate's opponent. And I, having been a delegate to Chicago, fully understand those, whether they went to Chicago or Miami Beach, who feel that they should not be associated with any candidate who emerged from those conventions. But as bitter as they might be, and I perhaps have more reason than most to be bitter about our political system and what it has done to some of its finest, as bitter as they might be, simply to drop out, to walk away in a peak, to say that because we didn't win, because we couldn't convince a majority, because we couldn't get our way, we're turning our backs on the whole election, is not only bad sportsmanship, but bad politics, because it means turning our rights and our roles and our responsibilities over to the very people whom we were competing against a few months ago. It means, if you do realize that one candidate is worse than the other with respect to the future of peace, with respect to the future of our black citizens, it means endangering the hopes and possibly the lives of millions of people in order to preserve the purity of our own integrity. Futilely pushing a fourth or fifth party candidate is even worse, because it not only has all the same handicaps of helping the major candidate whom you like the least, but it also hurts your own movement if you vote for a so-called peace candidate, for example. The turnout for such a candidate is going to be so small, and the tactics of such a party are going to be so thoroughly repudiated, that the peace movement will only be minimized and damaged in the minds of those successful congressional and presidential candidates. Moreover, as sophisticated as some may be who say they will vote for the good senatorial and congressional candidates, but not for any presidential candidate, history of election statistics makes very clear that the more we talk about no presidential candidate being worthy of support, the more less sophisticated voters will stay home on election day or go fishing on election day, because they don't think it's important enough to vote at all, and those deserving senatorial and congressional candidates will lose their support. Finally, I don't accept the view expressed by George Wallace and Ho Chi Minh, one of the few things they agree on, that there's not a dime's worth of difference. That's from Wallace, not from Ho. Between the two major presidential candidates. I have criticized both of them for their positions on Vietnam and their lack of positions on Vietnam. But they have important differences in their past records, which should not be overlooked, in their party philosophies, which should not be overlooked, and in their present positions as well. They take very different positions on the continuation of the Cold War and on the emphasis to be given to military rather than non-military answers to communism. They take very different attitudes on taking some risks for peace, on the emphasis and meaning to be given the so-called law and order issue, on the merits of more social legislation for our cities and our poverty dwellers. They do not agree on the desirability of action now on a nuclear non-proliferation treaty and on talks to limit strategic arms and anti-missile missiles. They did not agree on the Fortas nomination, and they do not agree on the priority to be given cutbacks in employment compared to cutbacks in inflation. They have selected, to put it mildly, very different kinds of men as their running mates. And I believe that indicates they would select very different kinds of men to be Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They would make very different use of the billions of dollars to be freed by the cessation of hostilities in Vietnam. They pay attention, and have always paid attention, to very different kinds of senators and academics and pressure groups in our society. I'm not here to make a partisan endorsement, although most of you should be able to guess from this how I feel. But I hope that whichever candidate you think is a little bit better or a little bit worse than the other, you will make up your mind to vote and work accordingly. I know there are those who say that even though their party's nominee is not as bad as the other party's nominee, they want to see him defeated. They want to see the worst man elected because they think somehow that will reform and revamp the party structure and enable the liberals to take over. There are those who hope that it's going to teach the hawks and the establishment a lesson so that in 1972, they will change their ways. Some hope that it's going to polarize or crystallize political thought in this country and improve the atmosphere for reform. Believe me, if you look at the historical record, those hopes are speculative and uncertain at best. What is certain is that this country is headed for a very difficult, if not desperate, 4 years. And that we have an obligation to go to the polls and vote on November 5, at least against the man who is least able to save us during those next 4 years. We have an obligation to speak out against him, to speak out in favor of the man whose views are closest to our own, even though we may disagree with him on other major issues. And they have an obligation, as I said at the outset, to speak out and tell us where they stand on major issues such as Vietnam. That is an obligation which is paramount in a country such as ours. Perhaps it was not the tradition in other countries. And that's why, in a sense, it's summed up by the statement, almost by way of confession, that was made by the famous German Protestant minister, Pastor Niemöller, in explaining his attitude in the early days of Nazi Germany. First, he said, they came after the communists. And I was not a communist, so I did not speak out. And then they came after the Jews. And I was not a Jew, so I did not speak out. And then they came after the trade unionists. I was not a trade unionist, so I did not speak out. Then they came after the Catholics. I was not a Catholic, so I did not speak out. And then they came after me, and there was no one left to speak out. My fellow citizens, I hope each and every one of us, as candidates or as constituents, as private citizens or as public officials, will meet our obligation to speak out on behalf of this great republic. Thank you.